lofty debt, war, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights. Tears at the fabric of our nation, and the tragic realization is that future generations will pay the big price. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow. So we better sow carefully. This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand, we cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow. So we better sow carefully.
Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore them. Shall we what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America. North to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Taking Back America, the official show of Take Back America for the people. We are an educational nonprofit whose mission is to inform the American people and people around the world about the costs of allowing corporate control of the U.S. government. Today we're going to return to a very familiar topic to our regular listeners, and that is the human and economic costs of war. My guest today is Gary Brumback. He is the author of America's Oldest Professions, Warring and Spying. He's kind of an interesting guy. He's about 80 years old. He's a retired industrial psychologist, and he's been spending a lot of time doing a lot of research into what causes war and giving a lot of thought to what we can do about it. So that's the topic for today. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rick.
Gary, why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Thank you, Rick. That's a great opening question. As you well know, books have sections called About the Author because readers deserve to know where their authors are coming from, just as your listeners need to know what kind of a person I am. So I will start from the beginning and fast forward about my lifeline. I was born a pacifist Quaker back in the 1930s, and so I have been opposed to war for about 80 years. I was very young when World War II was raging. But even at that young age, I knew that it was wrong, in my opinion. Then, in late high school, I guess as I graduated, I was scared to death because I got called up to take an Army physical. The Korean War was the reason. And so I had to go to Indianapolis, Indiana, and take a physical. And my knees were shaking. Fortunately, there was an armistice shortly thereafter, and I wasn't called up. But then, later on in undergraduate school, Vietnam was broiling. And I, in my deepest of feelings, knew that that was a terribly wrong war that should never begin. And so the reason I, one of the main reasons I went to graduate school, besides the fact that an undergraduate major in psychology doesn't have much of a career if he or she doesn't go on to graduate school, I went on to graduate school in order to get a continued student deferment. I did not want to be drafted into what I thought was a horribly wrong war. So after I graduated with a PhD in industrial organizational psychology, I had a long career in numerous places, including the federal government. Now, Rick, as you can probably appreciate, I muted my criticisms of what America's government was doing. For example, when I was in the federal government, President Lyndon Johnson was in office. Well, I was not about to go out on the street and shout, "President Johnson is an international war criminal." So basically, I was a moral coward. I retired in 1995. And that sort of relieved me from my obligations to various responsibilities to mute my oppositions. So I began a long career during retirement of doing research, which led me first to write a book called Tall Performance, From Short Organizations Through We Me Power. And what that book was about, quickly, was that tall organizations that command and control their people will be outperformed always by short organizations in which the people are empowered rather than controlled and commanded. So that book got published. Then it led me to the question, well, Gary, if that's the case, why are there so many tall organizations, particularly corporations, that still exist? Not only do they exist, they are reaping huge profits. That led me to the second book called The Devil's Marriage, Break Up the Corpocracy or Leave Democracy in the Lurch. A corpocracy, in my definition, is the devil's marriage between corporations and government. And you can be sure that corporations are in the driver's seat. And what I learned there is that corporations that would fail otherwise do not, because there are so many handouts, I call them corporate welfare, from the government. Plus, the government maintains a hands-off stance toward those corporations, so that corporations can do all kinds of harmful and illegal things, and they don't get held accountable for them. Now, when I wrote that book, I had a chapter called Corporate Handouts, and in that chapter, I had a small section on warfare welfare, and I talked about that in the book. And then I listed a bunch of initiatives that I thought ought to be taken if we were going to end corporate warfare welfare. So that led then to more research, which led me then to the current book that we're going to be discussing today, America's Oldest Professions, Warring and Spying. So there you have it. This third book is sort of a trilogy. The last part of a trilogy, and all three are based on about 20 years of research and thousands upon thousands of citations of the literature. I've written so much about the subject, and this third book is so packed full of facts, I can't even remember today everything I wrote in that book.
Well, I can certainly understand that. I've read the book and I agree with you. It is very concise, very packed with facts. I've actually read it twice myself and skimmed it again for this interview and still got more out of it every time I do it. So that's very interesting, Gary. I didn't realize. I knew this was your third book, but I didn't realize it was a trilogy. The first book being about business, I didn't see how that connected, but the way you describe it, I can see that it's just as much about democracy, because you're talking about the way that an organization is structured and how it functions best, and you can think about the country the same way. It sounds like that's what you're saying. Obviously, the second and third books are about democracy, and in particular, this latest book is about how war is a threat to democracy. And so when you get into the causes of why we have endless war and endless spying, you make the case that this is a direct threat to democracy. So, Gary, let's just go right to the heart of it. Why do we war and spy endlessly?
Well, Rick, it's a long story. America was born in the womb of war. She started out with a musket in one hand and a spyglass in the air in the other hand, and she waged the American Revolution. And that kind of predestined her, in a sense, toward the path she has taken ever since, namely that the solution to international situations and the solution to ways to expand into the new country at that time and then on beyond that was to rely on military interventions. So what we have, Rick, is a what I call a 240-some-year-old habit, a habit of behavior on the part of leaders of what I call America's war and spy club. And that club is made up of gold and silver and bronze members, and they start with the Oval Office and Congress and the Supreme Court and all of the war and spy agencies and all of the war and spy industrial corporations, and there are hundreds and hundreds of those, and all of the uniformed services and so on and so on. And so to understand why we have that continuous habit, it's sort of like an addiction. I relied on what I call a human equation that I created for that very first book that I mentioned. And let me explain what I mean by that equation. It may be what I think is the most important non-mathematical equation that any human being will ever see. Now, as people know, an equation has a left side and a right side. And let's apply that equation to America's warring and spying. So on the left side, we have two inputs to those habits. We have people, and we have the situations and systems that those people create and react to. And those two together produce on the right side the behavior of worrying and spying and the consequences of worrying and spying. And those consequences are horrifying, and I can go into those later on in the interview if you like. Now, let's take the left side inputs. People often say that, well, it's the system that causes America to do what it does. Well, systems don't operate by themselves. Systems aren't people. People create systems and people run systems. So we first have to look at the people. So let's look at what kinds of people are in that war and spy club I talked about. Let's take, for example, the top. level, the gold-plated members of the Workman Spy Club, the presidents of the United States, out of all of the presidents of America, only two have never waged any wars, and those two didn't because they either died of pneumonia or were assassinated in their first month in office. Now, what we know about presidents of the United States and leadership in general, and corporations, for example, is that they have certain personal characteristics that predispose them to the kind of behavior that we see in them. Those personal characteristics include, for example, their unprincipled moralism, their egotism, their ambition, their wealth, and so on and so on. As a matter of fact, there have even been studies of U.S. presidents that have concluded, and this really amazed me when I learned of this, these studies have concluded that all U.S. presidents have had psychopathic tendencies, namely that they have been remorseless in what they have done. They are arrogant, they are narcissistic, and so on. So we have very definite kinds of personal characteristics of people in this equation that lead toward warring and spying if we add what I call the next set of inputs, the bad vantages. Now, the bad
Gary, I'm going to interrupt you here because I want to I want to make sure that people are following this. What you're talking about is how certain factors tend to create these addictions in certain classes of people who are in a position to start wars. So we're starting out with presidents. Now, I just want to say that there may be studies that show that these characteristics are common in presidents, but I think we need to keep in mind that everybody, each president is an individual, just like each of us is an individual. Some have some of these traits in spades, and other ones, you'd really have to make an argument to make the case that every president is a psychopath. I would frankly disagree with that, regardless of who you're citing who says that. So let's, that aside, let's just say that it helps to be a psychopath if you're going to make wars, because if you really understand the nature of war and what causes them, what the goals are, you can make an argument that that is, in a sense, psychopathic. But I think it's pretty hard to say that, say, Lincoln had no remorse. I mean, he was a chronic depressive, and he was extremely melancholy most of the time. Regardless of whether you agree that the Civil War was justified or not, I think it's hard to make the case he was a psychopath. What would you say to that?
I would not say he was a psychopath, but I have read extensively about Abraham Lincoln, and I think he was morally challenged. For example, you can find in the literature quotations of his which reflect that he was actually a racist. He felt that the white man was superior. I think the reason that he did not discourage the Civil War, as actually I think he even helped get it started, and that, by the way, was probably, I think, the most deadly war as far as American fatalities. I think it were about 750,000 Americans killed in that needless civil war. And I think one of the reasons that he did not try to do anything to prevent that kind of situation, he was worried about possible invasions of foreign countries because America would have been weakened and divided. And he had his eye toward expansion in the West. And so he did not do anything to really stop that war from happening. I think he actually...
Well, Gary, I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you because this is a 501c3 nonprofit show. Got to stick to the facts. He opposed the Mexican War. I don't think he was an expansionist. It's hard to make that case, I think. So let's stick to the more objective facts here.
Well, okay, I'll do that. I would suggest any reader or any listener read the best historian of American history there ever was, Howard Zinn's The People's History of America, and see what he has to say about Lincoln and the Civil War.
Gary, I do want to make one other point, and that is that I totally agree with you that we can't worship people and see them as all good or all bad. That is a serious problem, and that's one of the reasons we can't have intelligent discourse about these things. You and I can talk about this and have these disagreements, and it's no big deal. But, you know, some people are so invested in believing that somebody was, you know, the greatest president ever because he could do no wrong and therefore not open to criticism. So how can we learn from the mistakes they made? So I support you criticizing our heroes like Lincoln, Washington, whoever. They were men. They were not without fault. I think it's great that you actually challenged the idea that the Revolutionary War was necessary. We don't really have time to go into the details of that, both sides of that argument, but it's certainly a valid point of view. I did think it was very interesting before we go on, and I know we're really I'm really interrupting, but when you said World War II was not a just war, I know you said you were a Quaker, so that in and of itself, it kind of speaks for itself. But objectively, why would you say World War II was not a just war?
Well, from what I have read, World War II could have been prevented. As a matter of fact, there were several industrial tycoons in America who actually helped Hitler build his industrial war machine. On the Pacific side, America had been, what should I say? They had been threatening Japan for years before World War II, because America wanted to get their markets into Asia. And I think Japan really thought that we were as much a threat to them as we thought they were a threat to us. And I think Howard Zinn, again, makes a perfectly good point that America, that World War II, for example, was not fought because of the Jewish Holocaust. It was not fought to free Europe from fascism. And he goes on several other reasons. I just think that World War II was an unnecessary war that we did not have to enter.
Okay, so you've made some factual statements that do bear up to scrutiny if people want to do the research, right? You said that U.S. industrialists were working with Hitler, and that is a fact. If you do a little research, you can find out that Prescott Bush was the head of an investment bank that was involved in financing Nazi Germany, Hitler's rise to power. He was also a large investor in a corporation that was doing business with IG Farben in violation of the Espionage Act during World War II. The corporation was convicted, but he wasn't. He became a senator, and we all know the rest of that story. His son became head of the CIA and then president, and then his son became president. And now we got another one of Prescott Bush's grandson's running for president. This is something that should scare people. And They don't see it. They don't make the connection between these people are internationalists. They clearly have done lots of things that arguably are not in the United States interest, but are in the interests of international corporations that arguably control the United States through campaign finance and lobbying and their connections, their business connections with people inside and outside of government. What you call the corpocracy, right?
Yes.
And of course, as you said, it also... on the Eastern Front, it was about Japan versus the United States and other Western countries trying to get into the Chinese market in particular, but Asia in general. And a big issue was oil, just as it is now. So connect the dots, people. This is what we're trying to do here. Sorry for that long diversion. Do you remember...
Let me interrupt and say, I really like one of your sayings I see on your website, that when the American people finally realize that war is not inevitable, that's when maybe we'll make some progress toward making war obsolete.
That's my personal belief, absolutely, very strong
belief. And it's mine too.
Well, Gary, let me just remind you that when I rudely interrupted you, you were talking about the human equation, and you were talking about the inputs that end up equaling warring and spying. First, you talked about the human factors, and I believe you were starting to talk now about the systemic factors, the what you call the habit helpers.
That's later on in the book. What I was getting ready to talk about is a term I coined, which I really like, if I may say so, bad vantages. Bad vantages are circumstances and situations in the second part of the, in the second input of that equation, that tempt or pressure people to do the wrong things. Those bad advantages give, advantage to bad behavior. Now, let's take the bad advantages of leaders, and we could say the bad advantages of the presidents of the United States. There are so many bad advantages that presidents face that I almost feel sorry for them. It's almost inevitable that they'll take America into war. I mentioned in the book eight of those bad advantages that apply to all leaders and particularly to presidents of the United States. And I don't think there's been any president that has been immune to those bad advantages. And I'll mention one, for example, what I call upside-down incentives. Now, an upside-down incentive is one that gives advantage to bad behavior and disadvantage to good behavior. And an example of that, when it comes to the War Spy Club and U.S. presidents, is that many people believe that our presidents and their offices and Congress, the leaders of Congress and what have you, the top officials in the government, are guilty of international war crimes, but they're never held accountable. And when you're never held accountable for bad behavior, you keep on behaving badly. And the one reason we are never held accountable in the international court, for example, is that America's governments have never signed an agreement with the International Criminal Court to be part of it. And that's totally understandable, because if we were part of that International Criminal Court, then we'd have to haul those public officials into court, and they'd probably be found guilty of international war crimes.
So what you're saying is a bad vantage is a circumstance or condition that tends to lead to bad behavior, gives the advantage, if they have a choice, it gives the advantage or the bad vantage toward them acting badly. And so in this case, what you're referring to is that there's no accountability. And in fact, they are rewarded for bad behavior. That's just one of several bad advantages you mentioned in your book.
Yes, Rick, there are indeed about seven, I think, more bad advantages. And what I would suggest is that readers or listeners go to the book and find out for themselves what those other bad advantages are. And I think they'll come away maybe with a little sympathy toward our American presidents and other leaders because of the temptations and pressures that they encounter.
Absolutely. Just so our listeners know, you also talk about the bad advantages for members of Congress and the bad advantages in the judiciary, which is a very short chapter, by the way, and I thought one of the more interesting ones. I'm trying to remember the details, but it's very short because basically the judiciary's major role in this has been to declare that corporations are people and money is speech, and therefore they can do whatever they want to influence elections. That's a huge factor in why corporations and the wealthy control who ends up in Congress and the White House and dictate their policies, both domestic and foreign policy, including war policy. So do check that out. That's the bad advantages. And one more time, the title of the book is America's Oldest Professions, Warring and Spying, by our guest today, Gary Brumback. So now, Gary, what all this is leading up to, you said that war is like an addiction for all these people in power. And you talk about, and I mentioned this earlier, habit helpers that help perpetuate this. What are habit helpers?
All right. They are people, for example, like I used to be, I'm ashamed to say. When I was in, I think maybe I alluded to this earlier, when I was working in the federal government, I was not about to go out and say bad things about President Lyndon B. Johnson. Now, there is a bunch of habit helpers. The corporate-owned mass media are one of the biggest habit helpers. When I say habit helpers, I mean individuals and organizations that make it easier for America's war and spy enterprise to continue doing what it's doing. Now, besides the mainstream media, which was very helpful, for example, in helping the government explain away or defend its invasion of Iraq, and to explain away why it was doing so terribly in the pursuit of that war. Other habit helpers, for example, perhaps the biggest, and I say maybe they should not even be called habit helpers. Maybe they should be right up there in the gold gold-plated members of the War Spy Club, and that are what I call banksters, i.e. the big financial institutions. A friend of mine has said that behind every war, you can find one or more banksters. Why is that? Well, think about what banks depend on. They depend on getting people into debt so they can earn interest from those debt holders. Now, there are two kinds of debt, good debt and bad debt. And I'll leave it at this. Bad debt is war debt. Now, let's move on to some other habit helpers.
Can I make a comment about that first, though, because I think it's very important?
You bet.
You know, people think you're a conspiracy theorist if you use the phrase all wars or banksters' wars or things like that. But there's actually an article by that title that's really an excellent one, and you can find it, All Wars Are Bankers' Wars, on whatreallyhappened.com. And it'll go through case by case how bankers benefit from wars. You mentioned debt. That's a big part of it. But you got to realize that when we talk about banks, we're also talking about investment houses, all of Wall Street and all their buddies. And banks make a ton because they're invested heavily in the armaments industry. They fund both sides. They fund the governments of both sides to buy weapons, and they get interest off that. Then they're also, like I said, invested in the industry that's selling the weapons. And they also have, you know, they're in commodities trading, so oil is important to them, excuse me, and other commodities. And everybody that knows anything about war knows that ultimately what they're about is getting the resources of other countries, and those resources may be the capital also, which is why debt is so important. And they do use that to force countries into debt. In fact, the cost of waging war can force countries into debt to the banks and make them essentially beholden to the banks, so that really the ones calling the shots are the banks. That's the point. And I've done whole shows on this, but I just want to mention that for people who haven't heard those shows. So, Gary, go ahead. What are some of the other habit helpers?
Okay. Well, this will, I'm sure, be controversial, but religion is another habit helper. Religion has a very organized religion has a very checkered record throughout civilization, the history of civilization, on its role in humankind waging war against each other. And it's kind of understandable to me in that religion is a, sort of like you see what you believe, and rather than believe what you see. And religion is full of all kinds of indoctrinations, and it doesn't help people think critically about what really is happening. And so I would have to say that organized religion, by and large, in today's time, is either neutral toward or sort of an implicit accomplice of war. I will mention, for example, a group of from an organized denomination of 8 million people worldwide that frequently come to my door. And I asked them one time, what is your organization's position toward America's drone strikes that kill more civilians than terrorists and include deaths of children and funeral processions and so on and so on? And they said, oh, politics is not our responsibility. And my immediate response was, well, I'm sorry, but shame on you. Jesus would have... if Jesus were alive, he would throw those people out of business.
Gary, I'm going to interrupt you again because, again, we got to keep this fact-based, and I think you're painting with too broad a brush here.
All right.
I know what denomination you're talking about, but I don't know for a fact that I don't know how they justify not having a position, but I do know that there are a number of churches who have taken strong political positions, including positions on war, but it's kind of complicated to do, especially the more the less hierarchical religion denominations. The less hierarchical you are, the harder it is to come up with a decision that represents the opinion of the group as a whole. So I think it's a little unfair to criticize them. Now, that said, I think I hear the core of what you're getting at, and that is that a lot of people who claim to be Christians or claim to be Muslims or claim to be Jews just disregard the central message of all the major religions, which is treat your brother as your neighbor, and find all kinds of justifications for war in their scriptures. But that is up to the individuals, and in some cases, the individual denominations. And I think we need to make that clear. We're not slamming religions in general. They do not necessarily brainwash. A lot of my religious friends don't for instance, regard the Bible as the literal truth. They believe it is true, but it's a matter of how you interpret it. Same with a lot of my Muslim friends. They acknowledge there are different ways to interpret it. But if you start by with the golden rule there, which Jesus said, this above all, you know, treat your neighbor as your brother, love thy neighbor as yourself, this above all. That means start there. And anything that doesn't correspond with that, you are misinterpreting. That's the way they look at it. And to me, that makes sense. So let's be fair. If we're going to criticize religion, let's be specific about what we're criticizing.
Well, again, I would suggest readers read my book about what I have to say. And since then, I'll say that I have contacted the really big religious organizations about this matter, and they have not replied. So anyway, as I mentioned, this is a controversial subject.
Well, Gary, I also want to make clear that I know you're not a religion bashing, because you said you come from a Christian background too, and you believe in the principles of nonviolence that denomination does preach, right? The Quakers.
Yes, they preach it.
Well, the Friends Society is one of the best anti-war groups in the world.
Well, I'll leave it at that.
Okay, that's an opinion. Let's just say they have that reputation.
That's right. That's a good putting. I would move on to, let's say, another group of habit helpers, and that would be education. And education is very much like religion. They fill young people's heads with doctrine. They don't really encourage critical thinking. And I have written several articles, for example, on the militarization of education in the United States. You would be hard put, for example, to find a high school where any high school history teacher or civics teacher gives an objective analysis of the Vietnam War. Those who do, and those who dare to say that was a wrong war precipitated by the United States for self-interest purposes, they get fired. And so I would have to call education, right, more so perhaps than religion, as a habit helper. Now, let's move on to another group that might surprise, or maybe not, people, and that is science. You cannot imagine the kinds of things that scientists, and the hard sciences particularly, come up with to help the war and spy business. Robotic soldiers, cockroaches that can go into caves, and so on and so on. Well, of course, the physicists were the ones who invented the atomic bomb. And I could list probably a dozen or so exotic kinds of weapons that that scientists have created. And I'd like to move to the social sciences. And here it gets kind of painful, because I'm a social scientist, i.e. a psychologist. Let me tell you about two of those social sciences. Anthropology is one. Anthropology was enlisted, I think, during at least World War I, if not before, to kind of help figure out what the enemy was all about and how they could be infiltrated and so on and so forth. As a matter of fact, the president of the American Anthropology Society, or back in the early 1900s, was, I think, forced to retire because of his criticism of his profession for being involved in supporting America's war and colonization efforts. Now, let me move very painfully, to my own profession. There may not be too many listeners who are not familiar with the fact that the American Psychological Association, and I'm a fellow of that association, what it has done to help give the administration, particularly the previous administration, an ethical cover for its torture program. Two psychologists in particular, for example, earned about $80 million for, quote, overseeing Guantanamo base torture program. And that is now being investigated. And that breaks my heart that my own profession would do something like that. But that profession was also facing a number of bad advantages, like they needed to maintain their income for psychologists. Psychology was beginning to wane. And hooking up with the federal government and the CIA was a way of helping to revive American psychology. So that's something that I regret having to mention, what I just did. So then we're all actually habit helpers. Rick, you and I are habit helpers. I just mentioned earlier in the program how I viewed my criticisms of our war programs when I worked for the federal government. There is another big habit helper I'll call the enemy. The U.S. government could not carry on all its overt and covert military operations if it did not have enemies to justify those operations and our horrendous national security budget of $1 trillion every year. So as one of my friends, Charles Durber, a famous sociologist, wrote in one of his books, America needs to marry one or two or three enemies in order to continue doing what it's doing, namely it's warring and spying. So those are basically the most prominent habit helpers.
Well, that's a nice in-depth description of what you're talking about with the habit helpers, and I thought that was one of the more interesting parts of the book, actually. So just so people know, there's a lot that we're not going into here. We're just focusing on a couple of things because I wanted to really get to talking about Gary's solutions, his proposed solutions. Now, being an organizational psychologist, organizational industrial psychologist, he has understands a lot about how systems work and how to organize so that something actually works in a step-by-step fashion, how to organize. So, Gary, you devote a substantial portion of your book, and we're just barely going to be able to touch it, I'm sure, to how do you build a movement strong enough to actually end the war. And it starts, you said, with building a, I can't remember the term now, a citizens' assembly for peace. What's that?
Well, let me first say it starts with Americans having a vision of what America could become rather than what it is. Americans get their visions mostly from Americans' leaders. Americans need to have their own vision of what America should be. And I call that vision an ultra-America. And it has a number of positive attributes, one of which, for example, is to be a peace-loving, law-abiding nation. Then I go on to say, okay, how do we achieve that vision, make it happen? Well, the first step would be, and it's a takeoff from what I said in the previous book, it would be to establish a citizens' assembly for peace. And what it would be to bring together all of the existing anti-war and peace organizations and get them to collaborate instead of operating on their own and persuade them to come up with a unified plan, a strategic plan of reforms to be carried out that would lead us on the path to peace. And then the next step would be for that assembly to do what it can to create a peace coalition. And that coalition would be comprised of probably 50 more million Americans who could be identified as what I call potential habit breakers. And they're in about, close to 40 different segments of our society. For example, one of them would be people who have lost their jobs, people who have had various grievances against the United States, people who don't like what the United States is doing. They could, with effort, be identified. And then it would be a matter of showing those people that, hey, all of your grievances are interconnected. The corpocracy is one of the connecting points, and within that corpocracy is the lower and spine chain. And if we could get 50 million or more Americans to form a massive coalition, that coalition could provide the pressure behind the Citizens Assembly to carry out their reform initiatives. And then I go on in the chapter to say what those reform initiatives might be.
Okay, now let's break this down a little bit, because it may sound a little grandiose to say we can get 50 million people together by telling them that their cause is related to the cause of ending war. However, in addition to, you understand as a psychologist, there are ways to reach out to these groups, even though they're sort of scattered all over. But you also say that because all these issues are connected, you can reach out to organized groups. So, for instance, when it comes to, how we're not investing in America and creating jobs, labor unions could help.
Absolutely.
Or we can't afford a healthcare system, so healthcare reformers could help. Or we're destroying the environment in our endless quest to find more fossil fuels, so you can get environmental groups on board. So you're talking, and when you talk about the coalition, you're talking about groups who aren't necessarily focused specifically on peace, but are organized, do have large numbers, and once they get that these issues are connected, they can help support the peace movement. I think that was
you just put it better than I did.
Well, it's in the book. I got it from the book. It's
okay.
I just want to make sure we mention that, because it didn't, people need to realize this isn't grandiose. And like I said, we don't have enough time to go into it in a lot of detail, but the book does go into this in a lot of detail. It's kind of hard to even know how to break it down in this short amount of time. Tell us more, though. You said reach out to habit breakers, and you said people who lost their jobs because the war economy is not treating them well. That's one group that you can reach out to. They could be habit breakers to fight this system. What other kinds of groups of individuals are habit breakers potentially?
There are probably, I have estimated maybe 50 or more million people who are dissatisfied with what is happening to America. We did not get into the point I make in the book about America being a failed state, for example, but among so-called developed nations, we rank the worst on a number of conditions like unemployment, high poverty rate, and so on and so on. So we need to reach out to people who have sub-minimum wages. Everyone in the United States should have at least an adequate standard of living wage. That's in the Human Declaration of Rights, I believe. So we've got people who are not making enough money. We have people who are not making enough money because they are unemployed. You mentioned some other groups. I think you made a beautiful point that I make in my book, but you made it better. We've got other groups. We've got people who are very, very worried about how we are destroying our environment and our species and various species, and how we are how global warming may be threatening us. So they represent people who could be mobilized. So those are just a few instances of people in the United States that I think we could reach out to. Now, the problem is we've got to find them as they are represented in groups, because they're, otherwise they don't have any leaders. They can't be identified. So what we need to do is go out and find all of those organizations that represent people with that the Constitution spoke about as we're going to provide for the common welfare. Well, these people's welfare are not being taken care of. And so we need to find those groups who represent these people and try to persuade them to forming a coalition of groups. And you mentioned a good one, for example, labor unions. Now, I have tried to get labor unions to organize, and it's extremely difficult. But I don't have good credentials in the labor union movement, even though as an organizational psychology, I was always on the side of unions. Mm-hmm. But it's just very difficult to get to these organizations and to get them to unite. But as you know, the saying, unite and we can divided and we're conquered, united and we can win. And so far we are a divided country, and we need to unite all of those Americans who have a vision, can learn about a vision of a new and better America, and can come together and to help make that vision come possible.
Well, Gary, I think that that's a very important point. I have also tried to communicate with unions about an issue near and dear to me, and that is a constitutional amendment I mentioned earlier establish serious campaign finance reform so we can get some members of Congress in there who will work for us. I think that's a very important issue, and it seems to me a no-brainer that unions should be on board with that. But and now, thanks to the help of a coalition I work with, I'm just starting to see some progress in getting them to listen. And the problem I perceive is that they have their own agenda, their own ways of doing things. They have their own history, their own trajectory, and it's very difficult to get them to take a look around, take another look from an outsider, like you said, like you or me, and get them to reconsider. So I got to say, the best experience I've had is, number one, approaching these groups as a coalition, as a representative of a coalition, getting an in with somebody who's already in and convince them and get them to be your advocate. That's what I see. The point being, there are ways to do this. There are substantial barriers, but we can't give up just because we don't have success at first. And one of the things I like about your book is that you don't just go to the obvious groups like unions. You also talked about going to farmers associations, small business associations. These are things that most people don't think about. And I thought that was really good that you brought that up in the book. Because what you're talking about is building a coalition of millions of people, tens of millions of people. You can't do that without thinking first about how you build that coalition. Gary, we are out of time, but I really want to thank you for being on the show today and for talking about your book, America's Oldest Professions, Warring and Spying. That's it for today on Taking Back America. Make sure and join us next